Welcome back to the Deep Dive, everybody. Today we're going to be looking at something that I think we can all relate to, and that's, you know, when you're buying something, especially if it's like, you know, used or secondhand, how much does the seller actually have to tell you? Like, where's the line between a good deal and, you know, maybe getting tricked?
Yeah, I think that's a question a lot of us have probably wondered about at some point, especially when you see those deals that seem almost too good to be true.
Exactly. And that's what makes this case we're diving into so interesting. It's called Eitan V. Bach from way back in 1977.
Eitan V. Bach. Okay, that sounds like it could be about anything. What's the story there?
Well, just picture this. You walk into a shop, see what you think are like some really cool old antique paintings, and the price is super low.
Okay, that's already getting my attention. Sounds like my kind of shopping trip. What happens next?
Well, they buy the paintings thinking they've scored this amazing deal. But then they find out, surprise, the paintings are reproductions, not actual antiques. And that's when the legal battle begins. This case actually went all the way from a DC small claims court up to the Court of Appeals.
Wow, so it's not just about a couple of paintings then, huh?
Definitely not. This case gets at something much bigger, like what are the rules when it comes to disclosure? Like how much does a seller have to reveal about what they're selling, especially when it comes to the authenticity of, well, anything, really. That's what we're going to try to figure out today.
I'm in. So where do we start with this whole disclosure thing?
Well, we'll dig into all those legal details, but first, I think it helps to like understand the specifics of this case, you know? But what happened with those paintings?
Yeah. Lay it on me. What were the facts of this Eitan V. Bach situation?
All right. So we've got this couple, the Eitans, right? They go into this art shop called the Ice House, and they spot these three paintings that like really catch their eye.
Okay. And what was it about these paintings that drew them in?
Well, they thought they were looking at authentic 19th century originals.
19th century? That's like pretty old, right?
Yeah, and that's what they thought too. They were looking at all these like little details. They noticed things like how brittle the canvases seemed, you know, little cracks here and there, discoloration that to them looked like natural aging.
Ah, like the patina of time, right?
Exactly. They even noticed things like what looked like old grease stains and even tiny puncture marks in the frames. You know, the kind of things that you might expect to see on something that's really old.
So they're convinced these are the real deal, these signs of age and all. And then they see the price tag.
Well, here's the thing. They bought all three paintings for a grand total of, get this, $157.50.
Wait, $157.50 for three paintings that they believe are 19th century originals. That doesn't even, like, that's crazy low, right?
Exactly. And that's a big part of the whole case. You know, should that price have been a red flag to them?
Yeah, you'd think so. Yep. What did the seller have to say for themselves?
Well, the owner of the shop, Mr. Bach, he admitted right off the bat that the paintings were, you know, reproductions. But his whole defense boiled down to the price.
Okay, so he's basically saying, hey, you got what you paid for.
Pretty much. He's saying, look, you paid less than $60 per painting. What were you realistically expecting here?
So was the court buying that argument?
Well, initially in the small claims court, yeah, they actually dismissed the Eitans case. They didn't think there was enough there for a legal claim.
Oh, no, so they lost.
At first, yes, but they felt really strongly that they'd been misled, you know, that something wasn't right. So they decided to appeal the decision.
Wow, they really believed in their case. That's commitment.
It is. And there was actually an attempt at a settlement at one point. During a conciliation proceeding, the court suggested they settle for $50.
$50? That's like nothing.
Right. But the Eitans, they rejected it. They felt like there was a bigger principle at stake. It wasn't just about the money for them.
So it sounds like they were fighting for more than just their wallets. They felt like they were in the right legally and ethically. So let's get into the actual legal arguments here. What were the Eitans claiming?
Their main point was that the seller had, like, broken an implied or express warranty. They were focused on those indicia of age, as they called them all, those little clues that made them think the paintings were old. Their argument was that the seller, seeing them focus on those signs, had a duty to say, hey, these aren't actually antiques.
So they're saying because the seller didn't correct their assumption, it was basically like a lie by omission.
Exactly. They felt like the seller knew what they were thinking and just let them believe it.
That's a tricky one for sure. And what about the other side? What was the seller's legal argument?
Their argument was pretty straightforward. They said, look, we never actually said these paintings were from the 19th century. We never claimed they were originals.
So never said it, not my problem.
Pretty much.
Yeah.
They argued that the price itself was a clear enough indicator.
So it's a classic buyer beware situation, according to them.
That's what they were going for. But of course, the court had to decide if that actually held up legally.
All right, so we've got these two sides, each with a pretty compelling argument. What were the big legal questions that the court needed to sort out?
Well, first, they had to figure out, does the seller's silence in this specific case count as a misrepresentation? Like, is staying quiet the same as lying?
That's a big one. Silence can be pretty powerful sometimes.
Absolutely. Then they had to grapple with this idea of implied warranties. Do those even apply to something like this? Like, when you're buying a cheap, used item, can you expect the same kind of guarantees as, say, buying a new car?
Yeah, there's definitely a difference between buying something from a fancy art gallery and picking up a painting at a flea market.
And finally, because this all started in small claims court, there's this question of, like, substantial justice. Like, how much does the court need to stick to the letter of the law versus just trying to reach a fair outcome, you know?
Right, because small claims court is all about, like, resolving these smaller disputes in a more practical way. So what did the Court of Appeals decide? Who won this whole thing?
In the end, the D.C. Court of Appeals actually sided with the seller. They upheld the small claims court's decision to dismiss the case.
So no 19th century paintings for the Eatons and no legal victory either.
Nope. But here's why the court really focused on that price tag, you know, the $50 per painting. They said that price was basically like a built-in warning sign. It was so low that it should have clued the buyers in that they weren't getting genuine antiques.
So they're saying that the price should have been a clue.
Yeah, and they use a really interesting analogy to explain their thinking. They compared it to buying cheap costume jewelry.
Costume jewelry? Okay, I'm intrigued. What's the connection there?
They basically said, look, if you buy a necklace that looks like it's all diamonds and pearls for like 20 bucks, you can't seriously think you're getting the real deal.
True enough, yeah.
And they said the same logic applies to those paintings. The ridiculously low price should tipped off the buyers that something was up.
So let the buyer beware wins the day.
In this case, yeah. The court also talked about implied warranties. Remember those? They basically said those warranties don't really work the same way when you're talking about secondhand stuff, especially when it's sold at such a low price.
Makes sense. If you're spending like thousands of dollars on something, you might expect some guarantees, but not so much for a few bucks at a yard sale.
Exactly. Now, remember that idea of substantial justice in small claims court? Well, the Court of Appeals emphasized that small claims courts are designed to be, you know, a little less formal. They're more focused on finding fair solutions, even if it means bending the rules a bit.
So they're prioritizing a common sense approach over strict legal technicalities.
Exactly. And in this case, they felt like letting the buyers win based solely on their assumption about the paintings wouldn't have been the fairest outcome, especially given that crazy low price.
Okay, I'm starting to get the big picture here, but let's rewind for a second and talk about those legal terms. The buyers said the seller's silence was a material misrepresentation. What does that even mean?
Well, in simple terms, a material misrepresentation is basically a lie that's significant enough to influence someone's decision to buy or sell something. But here's the catch, generally. Just staying quiet isn't considered a lie unless there's a specific duty to disclose information.
Like if there's a special relationship where you have to be extra honest?
Right. Or if you deliberately hide something you know is wrong with what you're selling. The court didn't find either of those situations here. The seller didn't flat out lie, and they didn't try to hide anything. They just didn't say anything at all.
And with that super low price, the court said it was up to the buyer to be a bit more skeptical.
Exactly. It really makes you think, right? Like when you see those online ads for vintage items at super cheap prices, maybe it's a good idea to be a little suspicious.
Vintage could mean a lot of things. So there was also something about a judicial notice controversy in this case. What was that about?
Oh, yeah, that was just a side point. Judicial notice is when a court accepts something as a fact without needing proof, like if it's common knowledge. There was some talk about whether the original judge in this case might have used their own personal knowledge of art to make their decision.
So, like, they were maybe an art buff and used that to judge the case?
Possibly. Yeah. But the Court of Appeals was pretty clear that they based their decision on the legal arguments, not on anyone's personal art expertise. The low price was the deciding factor, legally speaking.
So it was about applying the law, not about being an art critic.
Right. Now, this whole case also highlights the unique way that small claims courts work. In a more formal court, they might have been really strict about all the legal rules about warranties and misrepresentation.
So in a higher court, this could have gone differently.
Maybe. But in small claims court, it's more about finding a practical, fair solution. Remember, they even said substantial justice is more important than strict procedural formalities.
So it's less about the fine print and more about, like, what's fair in the situation.
Precisely. They have more leeway to look at the whole context of the case and make a decision based on what they think is right.
Okay, so for our listeners, especially those who are really into the law, what are the big takeaways from this A10 v. Back case? What can they learn from it?
Well, first off, this case shows that the price of something can be a huge red flag. If you're thinking about making a legal claim, the court might expect you to be a bit more careful when a deal seems too good to be true.
Right, so if you pay peanuts, you might get monkeys, as they say.
Pretty much. And it also highlights the limitations of implied warranties. When you're buying used goods, especially cheap ones, you can't always expect the same guarantees as you would with a brand new expensive item.
Good to know. It's like setting the right expectations from the get-go.
Definitely. And if you're ever in small claims court, remember that it's all about making a strong case for what's fair in the specific situation. The judge has a lot of power to decide what they think is the right outcome, so focus on that.
So it's not just about citing legal textbooks. You have to tell a good story, too.
Absolutely. But beyond all the legal stuff, I think the biggest takeaway is that age-old saying, if it seems too good to be true, it probably is. It's a reminder to be careful, do your research, and don't be afraid to ask questions if something seems off.
I think that's a great note to end on. Always ask questions. Don't just assume everything's on the up and up.
Yeah, I think this case is a good reminder that, you know, there's this constant back and forth between what a buyer should expect and what a seller has to disclose. And that costume jewelry analogy, I think, it makes us think about when a seller does have a bigger responsibility, to be honest, even if the price is low.
Yeah, like when does buyer beware cross the line into something more serious? It's definitely something to ponder.
It is. And at the end of the day, it's all about being aware of the assumptions we make when we're buying and selling things. And never underestimate the power of just asking those clarifying questions.
Words to live by, really.
They are. And on that note, thanks for joining us for another deep dive. We'll see you next time.
Until next time.